The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I should be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. And I'm going to start off with an apology. Last week, we had a technical issue right at the end of the program. So if you wonder why it kind of ended abruptly and then there was music for 2.5 minutes or so, it's because yours truly punched the wrong button. And that, unfortunately, is something that occasionally happens when you deal with computers, as many of you know. But what we will do is, later on when we get back to Consumer Reports, I'll finish up that section on insurance, which I think is kind of important for you to know. But in the meantime, let's go to the Reader's Digest for inspiration. And there's a picture of a bald-headed guy. Looks like he's probably in his 50s, maybe early 60s. It kind of looks like Mr. Clean. He's got big muscles, and he's got a piece of tape over his mouth he's pulling off. He's totally bald. The Sound of Silence. How shutting up for 3 months and walking more than 600 miles transformed my life. By D.C. Marshall. As long as I can remember, my mouth has been getting him into trouble. That sounds familiar. Growing up, I would say anything to get a laugh, no matter how crude or cutting. I used the gift of gab to get what I wanted from my parents, money, a later curfew, and to get out of what I didn't want, chores and groundings. I was asked to leave 4 different schools, mostly because I talked too much. And every one of my report cards is some variation of the same thing. I'd do so much better if I could just shut up. My mouth may have served me terribly as a student, but it set me up perfectly for a career in radio. In 2003, I launched a talk show on AM station in the Toronto area. He's a Canadian, by the way. I would ask people about their religious beliefs and the role faith played in their lives. In my 16 years hosting the show, I interviewed rabbis, nuns, witches, Wiccans, and Satanists, high priests, and had celebrities, politicians, religious leaders, and spiritual gurus share the why behind their beliefs. I think the show succeeded because it engaged people who don't usually listen to religious radio. People like me. After growing up in a church-going household and eventually become a pastor, I slowly began to reject organized religion. Still, I was fascinated by others' beliefs. I was consumed by the quest to understand the unknown and the unseen, and I traveled the world in search of answers. I prayed among ancient petroglyphs in Australia, slept at Stonehenge, and wept at the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem. I thought I would surely discover some divine truths if I visited all the sacred sites, interviewed every spiritual leader. But the only truth I discovered was this. I was selfish, egotistical, judgmental jerk. It hit me about 7 years ago when I was close to turning 50, and almost every significant relationship in my life was in tatters. My wife of 28 years wanted a divorce. My kids weren't my biggest fans. And when I asked my daughter what I was doing wrong, she told me she didn't have enough time to explain it all. I knew this much. The hunt for transcendence made me unbearable. I prioritized my radio show guest with whom I might spend an hour over the people who meant the most to me. I was constantly tearing into anyone I perceived as less enlightened than I was. Profanity and sarcasm were my default modes of communication. I drank too much and listened too little. I was miserable, as was everyone caught in my caustic orbit. My report card had been right. I'd do a lot better if I would just shut up. If my mouth was the root cause of my problems, maybe it was time to stop talking altogether. Years earlier, I'd watched a movie called The Way, starring Martin Sheen. I actually have seen that movie. It followed the main character's journey along the Camino de Santiago, a series of 1,200-year-old trails that converge on a cathedral in northwestern Spain, where the remains of St. James the Apostle are said to be buried. So in 2016, I decided to take a 3-month sabbatical from the radio show and walk the more than 600-mile route without saying a single word. My plan was to finish the trek on my 50th birthday as a changed man. When I arrived at the start of Camino in early October 2016, I was already worried that my quest was doomed. I was terrified that I'd accidentally speak, that my bum knees would prevent me from finishing the route, that even if I made the whole way, I'd return home still a schmuck. Nevertheless, hungover from the night before, I walked out of the charming French town of Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Puy and began my 2-month journey. The first trail was a steep incline into the Pyrenees, and my body hated every step. I quickly realized that my hiking boots were too narrow for my feet. My 28-plus backpack felt heavier with every stride. My knees started to creak, and sweat permeated my clothing. An hour in, I wanted to give up. I don't know whether it was my ego or the goal of becoming a better person that propelled me forward. Either way, I kept walking. Around the 7-mile mark, I trudged into the first albergue, one of hundreds of hostels along the Camino. The rustic abode, equipped with bunk beds and a rudimentary kitchen, was crawling with hikers speaking a potpourri of languages. It was there I began to understand that the physical challenge, excruciating it was, would be far easier than the vow of silence. And there's a picture of a wooden signpost that indicates the difference to different villages along the Camino de Santiago. And it's actually, you can look out and see the ocean in the distance and some mountains and a trails and see sheep in the field. It's very bucolic scenery. When the hostel staff or fellow traveler spoke to me, I pointed to my mouth, mind the act of talking with my hand, and then slid my index across my neck. I could usually get what I wanted using improvised hand signals. To ask for milk in my coffee, for instance, I pretended to milk a cow. If that didn't get the point across, I'd show people a note on my iPhone. Please forgive me for not talking. I'm traveling for 3 months in a vow of silence. You can still talk to me. And people did. Along the Camino, I was joined by pilgrims from Switzerland, Holland, Israel, and Ireland. Some walked with me in silence. Others shared their life stories. A gay man from Ireland told me about the rejection he'd experienced from his family. A woman shared her struggle to go on after the death of her child. I yearned to ask questions, to offer my advice or condolence, but all I could do was awkwardly type out a few questions on my phone. Yet I couldn't keep my judgmental side entirely in check. One morning, about a month into my trip, I woke up around 5:30, grabbed my pack, and walked downstairs to the hostel lobby, where I spotted a skinny, scruffy guy in his late 50s with the hair in a ponytail, staggering around and slurring his word. Drunk before dawn? What's your problem, dude? I didn't want him to accompany me on the trail, so I skipped breakfast and left. Later that day, I checked out one of the many historic and architecturally stunning churches that dot the Camino. When I returned to the path, I heard a voice say, "Boy in Camino," a common greeting among pilgrims. It was the guy I tried to avoid. I smiled politely and hurried off, thinking I could outpace him. But at 2 miles later, he was somehow still close behind me. Finally, he yelled out to me, and though I feared I'd spend the rest of my day listening to the rambles of a drunkard, I let him catch up. The man introduced us Nico and explained that he had Lou Gehrig's disease. It had ravaged his nervous system to the point where he'd stumbled and slurred. He decided to tackle the Camino while his body would still let him. I felt awful. Before the Camino, I had absurdly high standards for how a person should be, despite my own shortcomings. In my head, people were boring and predictable, and almost everyone fell into one of many categories I devised. Religious whack jobs, arrogant show-offs, incense-burnished virtue signalers, hopeless drunks, and so on. Unless they had something else to offer me, good looks, wealth, wisdom, and willingness to laugh at my jokes, I treated them as if they didn't exist. Before I knew anything about Nico, I had pigeonholed him. I literally deprived myself of a genuine human connection. Instead, we spent the next 3 days walking together. He told me stories about his career as a professional kickboxer, representing Germany internationally. I helped him fasten his belt and do up his jacket. We developed a profound bond, the very thing my life was lacking. By the time we parted, it was obvious. By opening my ears and my heart, I could actually like people. And by closing my mouth, I gave them a chance to actually like me. Most days followed a familiar rhythm. I'd rise before dawn, pack my bag, put on my jacket, lace up my boots, and walk for 6 to 12 hours. Every day was painful. One of my big toenails was black, and my pinky toes were calloused. My shoulders and back ached from the weight of my pack. Because of the orientation of the trail, the sun baked my left side of my face, which would leave me with a long-term skin damage. Still, there were moments of bliss. I was surrounded by endless fields of gold, mountainous air, soul-shattering sunrises. I snaked through deserted country villages and rested in the pews of majestic cathedrals. One morning, a little over halfway through my trip, I spotted the Spanish city of León in the distance. For most pilgrims, Leon offers a place to sleep in a proper bed, to wine and dine, and visit a museum or a gallery. For me, it was a reckoning. The city of 125,000 shared a name with my mother, Leone. She and my father had adopted me when I was an infant. They were a loving couple who ran a funeral home together and raised me and my sister in the apartment above the business. They were kind, patient people of integrity who gave back to their community. Despite their love and affection, I can never shake the fear of rejection. I'd do anything for other people's approval. As a kid, I once accepted a dare to give back a bag of multicolored rocks to a developmentally challenged child and tell him they were pieces of chewing gum. It was one of the many times throughout my life that I did something for a laugh at someone else's expense. I put my parents through hell. I flunked out of school numerous times. After ninth grade, I dropped out entirely. I refused to get a job and even stole the funeral hearse for joyrides before I had my driver's license. When they tried to discipline me, I would rage at them and run away from home. Just after I turned 17, I left home for good to work at a ranch in California. Despite receiving numerous letters from my mother, I never called or wrote back. 4 years later, she died of pancreatic cancer. I never got to say goodbye. By the time I was old enough to grasp how much pain I'd caused my mother, it was too late to apologize. The truth ate at me every day. I hated myself because of what I'd done. And that disdain emanated from me like a toxic cloud, infecting every relationship that followed. Outside Leon, I continued along the trail past a cemetery, where I noticed an older woman carrying flowers to a gravestone. As I approached, her face broke into a warm smile. I was stunned. She looked exactly like my mother. "Por el camino," she said, continuing on her way. I almost chased her down. To do what? I don't know. Even if I did speak, what would I say? "You look just like my dead mother. Can I give you a hug?" I knew it couldn't be her. But that sight of her made me realize how much I missed my mom, how much I wished I could tell her I was sorry. I broke down in tears as pilgrims and cyclists passed me by. A few days later, I came upon a monument called the Iron Cross. Compared to the elaborate ruins and ornate churches along the route, it was a remarkably ordinary structure, a metal cross atop a tall wooden post. At its base were tens of thousands of stones left by pilgrims. It's a communal tradition to leave a rock, symbolizing the unloading of a burden. Knowing this, I'd brought one from home. I held it in my hand, thinking of the grit I'd carried with me since my mother's death. Nothing will ever accuse the way I treated her, but holding on to my regret wasn't helping me or the people around me. I knew I had to let it go. There's a stone on the pile, and sobbing, kept walking. On November 30th, 2016, I woke up at 3:30 a.m. buzzing with excitement. I was only a few miles from the end of my journey, just as I had planned. It was my 50th birthday. My final destination was Cape Finisterre, on the west coast of Spain. His name means the end of the earth. With less than an hour left of my 60-day hike, I wandered off the path to climb to a high point in the pre-dawn darkness. Sitting alone, I watched the sun inch above the horizon, casting clouds and shades of pink and orange as fishing vessels began to leave the harbor. It was the most awe-inspiring sunrise I'd ever seen. Climbing down from my perch, I soon arrived at a worn 3-foot-tall stone marker denoting the end of the trail. An unfamiliar feeling swelled up inside me. Pride. I had done it. My back was spasming with pain. My whole body throbbed. But I was elated. I had overcome my fears, completed the journey, and kept my vow of silence. I felt good about myself for the first time in a long time. To cap off my trip, I arranged just a few weeks in a monastery on the Canary Islands, just off the western coast of Africa, silently writing and reflecting. The Camino was everything I'd hoped it would be. I had seen the good in humanity, I had shed my shell of negativity, and I had begun to make peace with the deep-seated pain that was preventing me from being the person I wanted to be. What would the monastery reveal? This. One night I awoke and realized that I needed to repair the most important relationship in my life, my marriage. I met my wife when we were both 20. She got pregnant, so we got married. We weren't madly in love, at least not then, but we were bringing life into the world, so it felt like the right thing to do. We had a son, then a daughter. A few years later, we poured ourselves into our kids' lives, ferrying them to school and sports. As I got older, My wife and I retreated into our jobs. She worked at a youth camp managing the barn, and I had my radio show. By the time our kids were adults, we were sleeping in different rooms. Our love had gone cold. When she turned 50 in early 2016, my wife went on a solo trip to Australia and did some reflection of her own. 2 weeks after she left, she sent me an email. She wanted out of our marriage. I was gutted, but I wasn't surprised. Yet before I left for the Camino, I had convinced her to stay. Lying in the monastery bed, I shuddered at the thought of ever letting her slip away again. Despite her ups and downs, she was the person I needed most in the world. She tolerated me with saintly patience, and I loved her immensely for it. My worst mistake was that I neglected to show it. After being home that December, I spoke for the first time in 90 days. On Christmas Eve, in a croaky, uneven voice, I apologized for everything and asked my wife to remarry me. She said yes. I wish I could tell you that was a happily ever after moment, that after all my soul searching, I restored all my relationship and never acted like a jerk again. Unfortunately, life isn't a Hallmark movie. Months after my return, my wife explained that she felt ambushed by my sudden proposal. She hadn't wanted to bring me down from my Camino high, so she said yes. Shortly after that conversation, she left. That felt like the end. But after a couple years of separation, we started going on dates again, and then we signed up for couples therapy. We concluded that investing in a future together was worth a shot. Our relationship is still a daily battle of choice, but giving up after 36 years of shared history seemed too easy. It took 2 years for me to realize that there was no squaring the new me with my old life. Or during the radio show, I felt myself reverting to the irritable, judgmental person I once was. The more I talked, the more I yearned for the Camino contentment, the serenity of unplugging from it all. Eventually, I decided if I was truly dedicated to becoming a better person, I needed a radical, permanent change. I quit the show, got rid of my phone, abandoned my social media accounts, and moved back with my wife on a 100-acre farm in Caledon, northwest of Toronto. Silence is now a part of my daily life. I am perfectly happy sitting on our front porch, literally watching the corn grow. 4 horses, 7 dogs, 30 chickens, and an ass named Grace keep me company. When I get a craving for social interaction, I ride my horse to the local watering hole. It still takes all my effort to keep my inner jerk at bay, and I fail often. But I found a way to keep the lessons of the Camino close at hand through SOS Retreats Canada. A couple of times a year, I welcome groups of 6 to 12 to the farm for a weekend, during which they walk a 31-mile trail in silence. In the evenings, we relax and verbally debrief around the fire. I'm not offering to help anyone find themselves, become successful, repair their marriage, or cope with grief. All I'm offering is a place to slow down, shut up, and listen. Because it's in the silence that the important stuff gets louder. And there's a picture of Cape Penisterre on the west coast of Spain. Marks the end of the Camino, and it's a chapel high on a cliff overlooking the ocean. And there's a picture of the author standing next to a sign that says 0 kilometers. No white noise. Snoring is basically bragging about being asleep so loudly that it stops other people from sleeping. Now a dear reader letter from the heart, from the Chief Conscience Officer of the Reader's Digest, Jason Burmester. The heart of the city. When Buffalo Bills player Damar Hamlin collapsed on the field during the first quarter of Monday Night Football game on January 2nd, viewers around the world held their breath. I was one of them. I sat on the couch with my sons and watched as trainers and first responders used CPR and an automated external defibrillation AED device for 10 minutes before rushing him into a hospital. Doctors determined that the then 24-year-old had suffered commotio cordis, a rare type of cardiac arrest that the American Heart Association defines as a result of blunt force trauma to the heart that happens exactly the wrong time in the heart rhythm. During his hospitalization, people in Buffalo held vigils, and fans everywhere flooded him with cards and letters and donated millions of dollars to his charitable organization. By April, Splashes cleared Hamlin to return to football. At a news conference announcing his return, Hamlin said, "I just want to show people that fear is a choice that you can keep going in something without having the answers and without knowing what's at the end of the tunnel. You might feel anxious, you might feel any type of way, but you just keep putting that right foot in front of the left one, and you keep going. I want to stand for that. I was inspired by what Hamlin said, by the way the people of Buffalo rallied around him, and by the outpouring of love he gave the city in return. His situation captured everything we look for in our annual search for the nicest place in America. So I was thrilled when Hamlin agreed to write about his journey for us. I hope you find it as inspiring as I do. And we'll get to that a little later. World of Good, Reasons to Smile. Violence for Everybody. As Mary Elizabeth Brown, who's pictured below, who is a young lady with a white violin and a big bow and a smile on her face and glasses and short brown hair, draws the bow across the violin strings. A dark and mellow sound emanates through the room. Brown has been playing the violin since she was 5, but this one is different. This one is the 3D printed in polyester plastic for less than $37. Traditional wood violins can sell for thousands. It's part of a project to improve access to music education for kids of all economic backgrounds, says Brown, director of the Aviva Young Artist Program in Montreal. It's my hope that future music students will find these instruments engaging to make, easy to play, an inspiring start to their musical journeys. That's kind of cool. I mean, it looks just like a regular violin, but it's pure white. Now, the bow looks like it's a real bow. Everyday Heroes. And there's a picture of a gentleman, middle-aged, slightly older, John Galeen, with the kayak and shovel he used to paddle to the pilot. And obviously he's in a kayak and he used a shovel for a paddle. When a small plane crashes into a frozen creek, a kayaker must navigate the ice to save the pilot. Imagine sitting in your breakfast nook having a cup of coffee when all of a sudden you see someone about to die. What would you do? Last Christmas, John Jeline found out. At December 26, Jeline, 60, was gazing out the back windows of his home in Edgewater, Maryland, on Frozen Beards Creek. Children and grandchildren bustled around the house. That's when Jeline's daughter, Amy DeMaio, spotted the Piper Cherokee. Look, she cried. Jeline looked up just in time to see a small craft a few hundred yards away losing altitude. As the plane disappeared behind the trees, Jeline, a former Navy commander and current cybersecurity expert, realized it was going to land in the creek. He flashed on a moment from more than 20 years ago, September 11, 2001. Jeline was at work in the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., when a terrorist crashed a jumbo jet into the building. He fled the chaos and has always wondered if he could have stayed inside and helped. To the right was the crisis, and to the left was escape. I didn't even know if I could have gone right, but I went left, he recalled. I've always second-guessed myself about that decision. On this day, Galeen didn't hesitate. He ran down to the waterfront. The plane had skidded to a stop on the broad frozen creek, far from shore. It was now sinking. The pilot was standing on the wing. Jeline knew from his Navy training that even a few minutes in the ice or water could kill the pilot. Jeline tested the ice with his foot and decided not to take any chances walking on it. So he and his son, John Jr., 37, pulled two kayaks out from under their back deck. I figure if it can float in the water, it can slide on the ice, Jeline said. The kayak's paddles proved too flimsy, so the pair tried using shovels to push the boats along. The first attempts left them spinning in circles, but with some muscle they made progress. The two men set off, pushing their boats across the ice. It was exhausting work. When Jeline reached the plane, it had broken through the ice and sunk. Only its tail was visible. The pilot was standing on a tail wing, submerged up to his chest, surrounded by open water. Jeline nudged his kayak off the ice and into the water, paddling toward the pilot and thinking, what if he panics? What if I flip? With the sun nearby, Jeline focused on keeping the pilot calm, joking. Just hang onto the boat as if you were hugging your wife, the pilot grabbed the kayak's bow. Now the two men were floating together. But Jeline knew he had to get the pilot out of the water and up onto the shelf of unbroken ice behind him before the man lost too much body heat. But each time Jeline tried to land atop the ice shelf, the kayak broke through. He needed the other man's help. He said, I'm going to push real hard, and you kick real hard. I'm damned if we didn't get up onto the ice, Jeline says. By now, a police officer had arrived and radioed for help. A boat from the Maryland Department of Natural Resources appeared, breaking through the ice as it arrived. It picked up the pilot, Steve Couchman, 71, and whisked him to safety. He would be treated for minor injuries. Later, the boat returned to help Jeline, now exhausted, to shore. John Jr. made his own way back after salvaging a bag containing vital flight logs, which the pilot had thrown onto the ice. The cavalry had arrived just in time, Jeline recalled. I'm 60 years old, he says. There was no way I could get him to shore. Still, he was satisfied he'd done the right way that day. Best pet pals. And there's a picture of a white duck with a big fluffy thing of feathers on its head. It's called Crazy Duck from South Milwaukee, Wisconsin. One day, my sister brought home a biology product, a duckling she'd hatched from an incubator. He's imprinted on me, she said. Just watch. As she walked away, the duckling let out a frantic peep and followed her. We set him up in a box with the duck photos pasted on it so he wouldn't get lonely. Eventually, he lost his yellow down and a tuft of feathers sprouted atop his head, and he was thenceforth known as Crazy Duck. He was always vying for attention. If you walked by his box without taking him out, he quacked furiously. We'd sit a doll nearby, and Crazy Duck, clearly nearsighted, quieted down. If I broke curfew, I'd have to sprint by before he saw me, or everyone would know I'd sneaked in. He loved TV. Some shows mesmerized him. We could tell because he would breathe deeply through his nostrils. He loved grocery commercials and pecked at veggies on the screen. As he grew, he started to become irritable in his box. We released him in our grandparents' farm, where he could enjoy his freedom. And it looks like he does, because he's swimming around the pond. Life, he works in mysterious ways. This is life in these United States. Before our young daughter went off to her Sunday school class, she told us she needed money. What for, I asked. I need to give it to my teacher, she said, Miss God. As he was putting his six-year-old daughter to bed, our son, a pastor, told her, I love you, and Jesus loves you, too. She replied sleepily, and I love you two guys as well. On Easter Sunday, upon seeing Jesus on the cross above the church altar, my three-year-old granddaughter experienced a moment of confusion, shouting, there's a scarecrow up there. During communion, when pieces of bread were passed around, my three-year-old grandson asked hopefully, does it come with chicken? And now let's switch over to Consumer Reports and to the part I missed about insurance last week. And part of this article is the new policies to consider. Umbrella insurance. Why you may need it. You own more assets than your home or auto policy can protect. You own a rental property or have a pool or a boat. What to do. Umbrella insurance protects you if you're sued and found liable for an amount greater than the liability limits of your home or auto policies. Because umbrella insurance kicks in only after those policies are tapped out, it tends to be relatively inexpensive. $200 to $400 a year can typically buy $1 million of coverage. Most umbrella insurance claims result from car crashes, but you should consider this coverage if you're highly exposed to lawsuits, if you own a rental property, boat, or swimming pool, for example. How much do you need? You generally want to protect the full value of all your assets that exceed the liability limits of your home and insurance and auto policies. Qualified retirement assets such as 401k plan savings are safe from legal judgments, but do count your home equity, which in some states is accessible to creditors. Flood insurance. Why you may need it. Homeowners policies don't cover water from outside your home. A lot of people don't know that. That's very important. Climate changes is making storms more frequent and destructive, and new land use and developments are changing how water flows and drains. What to do? Most homeowners' policies cover water damage caused by pipe or a system within your home, but protection from water coming from outside, flood insurance, is a must. You definitely need it if you live in a special flood hazard area, as per the Federal Emergency Management Agency's flood maps. To find out, go to msc.fema.gov/portal/home. But consider it even if that's not the case. About 40% of claims on FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program come from outside risk areas. Most flood policies in the U.S. are underwritten by the NFIP and can be purchased through private insurance agencies. The median annual cost is $865 for homeowners who are in special flood hazard areas, and $689 for those who are not. NFIP policies cover up to $250,000 for a home structure and $100,000 for the contents. Private flood insurance is available if you need more coverage, but it can be expensive. There are ways to save money on flood insurance. You can get a discount for risk mitigation like elevating electrical panels and utilities, such as heating or cooling systems. You could also get a discount if your community has taken steps to reduce its risk of flooding and enrolled in NFIP's community rating system. And, as with other types of insurance, you can pay a lower premium if you raise your deductible. To learn more about flood insurance to find out how much it would cost to get for your home, go to floodsmart.gov. Coverage you may not need, and this is kind of important. Long-term care insurance. Traditional long-term care, LTC, insurance, which pays for care at home or at an assisted living or nursing facility, has been problematic in recent years. Prices on policies have gone up dramatically, and many insurers have left the industry altogether. Recently, a newer form of LTC insurance has gained popularity. Known as hybrids because they combine long-term care benefits with permanent life insurance. These policies let you tap some of the death benefit in advance to pay for care if you need it, and your beneficiaries get it if you don't. Hybrid policies address some of the problems associated with traditional LTC insurance. They're not use it or lose it, for one thing, but they have problems of their own, according to hidden fees, including hidden fees, high costs, and extreme complexity, says Bonnie Burns, on LTC insurance expert and consumer representative at the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. Her recommendation: consider insurance in the context of a broader conversations with family members about long-term care, including how to pay for it, what kind of care you want, and who will manage the care if you're unable. And if you decide to purchase it, consider your options with an objective financial advisor, ideally a fiduciary who understands your full financial picture and the nuances of the policy. Burial insurance. This insurance is meant to cover funeral-related expenses and pay a relatively small death benefit of between $5,000 to $25,000. Nobody wants to saddle their loved ones at the big funeral bureau. In 2021, median cost of a funeral was $7,848 with burial and $6,971 with cremation, according to the National Funeral Directors Association. But burial insurance is probably not the best way to help, because policies tend to be expensive relative to the benefit they provide. A recent study of Forbes found that the average cost for a 60-year-old male to get $10,000 of coverage was more than $750 a year. They also tend to have graded benefits, meaning if you die in the first few years, your beneficiaries may only get a refund of the premiums you paid. Better, if you can afford it, is to set funds aside in advance for your funeral and leave instructions for your family members. Now a letter from the president of Consumer Reports. Trust at the tap. Nothing is more vital to our health than the safety of the food and water we put into our bodies. That's why this issue of Consumer Reports magazine is anchored by a 10-page guide to some of the riskiest foods in American diet and how you and your family can make safer choices. It's also why CR has been working so hard to ensure the safety of the water we drink. In 2021, we published an investigation into the nation's drinking water in partnership with the Guardian U.S. News Organization and consumer volunteers across the country who collected samples of their local tap water. The result? Of 120 samples tested, 118 contained detectable amounts of lead or levels of arsenic, or PFAS, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, that exceeded those considered safe by CR and other experts. This year, we focused our efforts on testing on water in Mississippi. Working with the Journalism Collaborative Mississippi Spotlight, we collected 149 tap and well water samples across the state. The results were also deeply concerning. Nearly all had detectable levels of PFAS and lead, while every sample contained arsenic. While CR rates filters that can use to improve the quality of the water you drink, this burden shouldn't fall on individual consumers. So we're calling on Mississippi officials to provide all households in the state with effective filters and urging the Environmental Protection Agency to finalize limits on PFAS for drinking water nationwide. At CR, we will remain vigilant and continue to take steps to ensure the trust of tap in all communities. Fighting junk fees. Oh, $450 is the average annual amount paid per customer for company-imposed cable fees, not included in the advertising fee prices. If you're tired of being surprised by mysterious fees on your cable bill, there may be soon good news. The Federal Communication Commission has proposed a rule that will require pay TV companies to provide consumers with upfront all-in pricing at their services, including charges broadcast TV and regional sports fees that consumers often don't learn about until their bills arrive. Hidden fees like these make it difficult for consumers to stick to their household budgets, and almost impossible for them to shop around for the best deals. That's why CR has been advocating for pricing transparency and the elimination of so-called junk fees across many industries. The FCC's proposal cited CR's 2019 What the Fee report, which raised the alarm about the proliferation of company-imposed fees on cable and satellite TV bills. Based on an analysis of almost 800 cable bills collected from consumers across the country, that report determined that hidden fees added amount to about 24% surcharge on top of the advertised prices. CR is urging the FCC to adapt the proposal and will participate in the FCC proceedings as it moves forward. CR is also calling on Congress to pass the Junk Fee Prevention Act, a broader measure that would, among other things, require hotels and event ticket sellers to disclose all fees up front, require airlines to let kids sit next to a family member at no extra charge, and save consumers up to $9 billion a year in credit card late fees. You can support our efforts by adding your signature at cr.org/junkfeepetition. I think I'll sign that, baby. Auto safety update. In June, CR auto testers discovered a serious safety issue. The brake lights on certain Genesis, Hyundai, and Kia electric vehicles sometimes did not illuminate when the cars decelerated, while a feature called one-pedal driving was in use. Within weeks, Genesis, Hyundai, and Kia said they'd be rolling out a fix by the fall. CR found that even some Mercedes EVs have a similar problem, which the company has not yet addressed. We're now calling on the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to update safety standards to make it clear that brake lights must illuminate when a car rapidly decelerates. Safer shopping online. What's at stake? Online marketplaces that offer a platform for third-party sellers to hawk their goods can be rife with counterfeits, many of which can pose serious dangers to consumers, including bike helmets, water filters, auto airbags, and even medications. Compounding the problem, consumers often lack the basic information necessary to make smart decisions about buying products on these platforms, including the seller's identity, where the products are made, and what materials they're made with. What is CR doing about it? CR has long pushed to hold companies more accountable for the goods sold on their platforms and to make those platforms more transparent so that consumers can better protect themselves. In 2020, for example, we testified at a House hearing on fake and unsafe products, and in 2021 we endorsed the Informed Consumers Act, which targets the sale of counterfeit goods and later delivered some 38,000 consumer signatures in support of the legislation to members of Congress. The bill passed in 2022 and went into effect June 27th. Among other provisions, it provides that e-commerce websites to display identifying information about third parties that sell high volume of goods on their platforms, to suspend sellers that don't supply that information, and to offer a clear way for consumers to report suspicious conduct. CR is now pushing for additional rules that will require online marketplaces to take greater responsibility for the safety of products sold by third-party sellers. What you can do? Find CR's tips on how to avoid buying counterfeit goods online at cr.org/fakestuff. Your feedback. How to beat the rising cost of Rx drugs. Our August 2020 article, How to Beat the Rising Cost of Rx Drugs, shared simple ways to solve problems like insurance plan changes, expired coupons, and more. Readers offered their own thoughts on advice. To add yours, head to cr.org/saveondrugs. The article had many great suggestions, but I noticed that in the More Ways to Save on Your Meds section, you did not mention anyone can use GoodRx without paying a fee. It's true that if you choose GoodRx Gold, there's a monthly fee and the drugs are less expensive. But just using the GoodRx website to check prices and search for coupons has lowered my drug costs by hundreds of dollars per year quarter with no fee. Please let your readers know that if they have a federal insurance program, Medicare, Medicaid, etc., the law prohibits the use of manufacturer coupons in conjunction with their plan and a combination of benefits, COB. Editor's note, although you usually can't take advantage of manufacturer's coupons with your federal plan, you might be eligible to use one if the drug you need isn't covered by the federal plan. Each company's program is different, and it's always worth contacting the drug manufacturer and asking for specifics about your eligibility. As a recent retired registered nurse, I thought your article had good advice to help consumers. However, Unless some basic problems are eliminated, our healthcare system will continue to be full of flaws that are detrimental to health and even life-threatening. Formularies, a list of drugs that insurers will cover, should be eradicated. There are special deals between insurance companies and big pharma and don't benefit patients. Providers should be able to prescribe the medication that is best for the patient, not just what the insurance company will cover. And prior authorizations required by insurance companies, which can take weeks for approval, only work when a patient does not need the medication right away. So if there were no formularies, patients would get prescriptions in a more timely manner. Scam-proof phone lines. Regarding CR's Scam Protection Guide, my elderly father and many non-tech survey people like him is tied to the landline that he has had forever and does not own a smartphone or a computer. Your article addresses scam detection and blocking for mobile phones, but offers no option for those who have a wired phone. Is there nothing that could be done to help protect him from being scammed? Editor's note. Those who use a landline can ask their phone service carrier about call labeling and call blocking services they offer, according to the Federal Trade Commission, FTC. Some may be free, others may have a cost associated. For instance, AT&T allows customers to block up to 10 local phone numbers by pressing *60 on the keypad and following simple instructions. Pressing *77 rejects calls from people who are using a feature that prevents their name and number from being displayed. Verizon has verified caller ID, which displays a V when a caller's phone provider is confirmed that they're using an authentic number, not one that's been spoofed or faked. The company also offers spam alerts on caller ID. Another option is a call blocking device, which is a small box you attach to your phone on Amazon. These start at about $30. Best toilet height. This is a sitting business here. The new Comfort Height toilets you refer to in Easy Ideas for a Better, Safer Bathroom can be anything but comfortable for shorter users. Imagine sitting on a high seat enough with your feet don't completely touch the floor. I made this discovery recently after purchasing a new toilet. I didn't pay much attention to the ADA-compliant product description because the toilet was identical in brand and model name to the one replaced. As it turns out, it's almost 2 inches taller. ADA-compliant and comfort height seem to mean the same thing in terms of toilet height. Editor's note, you're right. ADA-compliant and comfort height both indicate a toilet that's between 17 and 19 inches from the floor to the top of the seat. A standard toilet is usually between 14.5 and 16 inches high. When shopping for a toilet, be sure to check its height before you buy. Ideally, try to check out the model you're considering in person. If a comfort height toilet isn't right for you, a standard height Kohler Wentworth K3575 for $285 has performed well in our tests. Fruit fly removal. In the Ask Our Experts column, you missed out on a great tool for getting rid of fruit flies fast. If you already have an active infestation, your vacuum cleaner. Fruit flies are really slow. With the aid of a vacuum cleaner wand, it's possible to vacuum up hundreds of fruit flies in a couple of 5-minute sessions. If you're worried they'll escape your vac, you can either empty it right away, outside, or the bag around the hose and after you've done. This won't clean up the source of the infestation, but it will buy you some sanity while you start implementing CR's best tips for avoiding another infestation. Don't ask me how I know this. Just let's say my family loves bananas and leave it at that. Editor's note. A vacuum cleaner may indeed be the perfect stopgap solution while you find the source of an infestation. We asked Jody L. Gangloff-Kaufman, an integrated pest management expert at Cornell University, about this method, and she says it's one she uses herself. Do you want stuff off something at the end of the house to into the hose to keep any living flies from escaping, she explains. She also suggests using your vacuum elsewhere in the house after sucking up the fruit flies, because the debris can help keep live flies trapped. Without a source of moisture inside the vacuum, she says, the trapped insects likely couldn't reproduce, even if they did survive the vacuuming process. Loss of a CR legend. Rhoda Karpatkin, a champion for consumers and a president of Consumer Reports from 1974 to 2001, passed away in August at the age of 93. Karpatkin's vision and leadership played an enormous role in making CR the trusted organization that it is today. She professed strength and tenacity and used both to propel CR forward, taking bold positions on important safety issues and compelling manufacturers to improve products based on her rigorous testing and in-depth reporting. In the year she led CR, Karpatkin steered the development and expansion of our testing labs on our outer test track. The results of those initiatives gave CR the ability to advocate for a better product safety and important legislative reforms. During her tenure, CR waged successful campaigns to improve car seat safety, pushed automakers to redesign vehicles to make them less likely to roll over. I remember seeing videos about that. And lobbied federal regulators for safety standards on lawnmowers, indoor kerosene heaters, and microwave ovens. Karpatkin upheld CR's independence, continuing Consumer Reports' legacy of never accepting paid advertising. Marta L. Tolado, CR's president and chief executive, said of Karpatkin, "She is a true and enduring icon of the consumer movement. Her legacy will be felt for generations to come." Join the Consumer Reports Board. Consumer Reports is seeking dynamic, dedicated candidates with a desire to advance our mission and improve the lives of our consumers by serving on our board of directors. Ideal candidates will bring creativity, diversity of background, and thought experience in leadership, and a passion for empowering consumers and working to create a fair and just marketplace for all. Applications will be submitted online, cr.org/board application, by December 5, 2023. A committee of the board will review applications, conduct interviews, and recommend a slate to stand for election of a 3-year term of boards beginning October 2024. Board members are required to attend 3 meetings per year and participate in board business on an ongoing basis. No compensation is provided, but travel expenses are covered. What we're testing in our labs. In our 63 labs, we continue to review and rate products. Here are timely picks for this month. Impact drivers. How many people need impact drivers? 35 models. We test for how powerful the driver is, runtime per battery charge, and how long the battery takes to recharge. Noise measured in decibels and more. The scores, the median was 70, the range was 33 to 90. Well, that's a big range. Fast charging and a long runtime on the Flex FX 1351, $125, score to 90. Easy to handle, DeWalt DCF88 7D2, $200, score to 83. Powerful budget buy, the Bauer 1781C, $60, score to 66. Mattress toppers. We tested 13 models to test for, the test for the level of support, including how well a topper conforms to a sleeper's shape, warmth of the topper, and more. The median score was 87. The range was 79 to 94. Top performer and plush was the Dermo 3-inch, $380, 94. Similar comfort for less, Bedstore 3 memory foam at $147, score to 93. Thinner and sleeps cooler, the Penza number 2-inch memory foam, $60, score to 82. Can a mattress topper make an older bed more comfortable? The mattress topper can add cushioning to an older mattress, but it won't magically transform one that's worn out. A supportive mattress is essential for maintaining proper spinal alignment while you sleep. So if yours sags, you need a new mattress. A topper can, however, make supportive mattress more comfortable. If your mattress is too firm, a topper can add softness, says Chris Reagan, who oversees CR's mattress testing. Toppers also provide pressure point relief, especially beneficial to side and back sleepers. And memory foam toppers can reduce motion transfer, making them ideal if you sleep with a restless partner. If you get hot at night, then let's spend linen spa above trap less heat in our tests. Battery leaf blowers for $200 or less. We tested 20 handheld models. We test for how quickly a blower loosens and removes embedded leaves from a lawn, a model's noise level and ease of use, and more. About the scores, the median was 73, the range was 37 to 85. Top tested in high owner satisfaction is the Ego LB6151 at $200, scored an 85. Moves these quickly is the Toro 51821 at $190, scored an 81. And the lightweight was the Skill BL4714 at $130, scored a 77. Smokeless fire pits. 7 models. How well each fire pit burns a small and larger load of wood, how easy it is to clean, how much the pit rusts during testing, and more. Median score was 74. The range was 53 to 90. Best for big fires was the Cousinor Clean Burn Fire Pit at $249. It scored a 90. Easy to clean and a nice price, the Eno Stage Smokeless at $85, scored an 86. Resist rusting well, BioLite Fire Pit at $300, scored a 61. soundbars. We tested 77 models, sound quality which encompasses tonal accuracy and the ability to reduce fine sonic detail and ease of setup and use. This median was 52, the range was 30 to 73. User-friendly but pricey was the Sonos Arc soundbar at $900, scored a 73. Wow. Good sound and useful feature was the Denon Home soundbar 550 at $650, scored a 60. Bargain with basic features was the Vizio SB3221 and J6, $170, scored a 58. Those things are more expensive than the TVs they'd be with. Strollers under $150. We tested 17 models. We test for how well a stroller maneuvers on hills, pavement, grass, and dirt trails, how safe a model is, and how easy it is to fold. The median score was 73, the range was 54 to 80. And nice for jogging, the Baby Trend Expedition Jogger at $130, scored a 78. Small for quick storage, the Chico Lightweight Stroller, $110, scored a 76. Built for two, Dream by Me Twins side-by-side at $120, scored a 62. I remember back in the days when I was a young father, the strollers cost about $15, and they were little wiry things. These things look like they're the Mercedes-Benz of strollers. Do I need to replace that old fire extinguisher even if I've never used it? While you won't find an expiration date on your fire extinguisher, the typical lifespan of an unused one is about 10 to 12 years from when it was manufactured. That info can be located on the UL nameplate label on the canister. But many people hold onto their fire extinguishers far longer than they should. Last year, CR asked 68 of our members who own fire extinguishers to examine them and test them in their homes. We found that almost half of the extinguished tested were 20 or more years old. 18 participants all reported at least one visible problem with their extinguisher, such as low pressure readings, rust, scratches, or dents. Some also said there was an issue with the pull pin. When used, three failed to let out any extinguishing agent. If your fire extinguisher is too old or visibly damaged, manufacturers recommend replacing it with a larger extinguisher you can safely handle. About 5 to 10 pounds is common. For a guide to the best spots to place your fire extinguishers in your home, go to cr.org/extinguisher map. Is it really so bad to write down my password? It depends. If you're in a shared space like an office where someone might easily come across your list of passwords, it's not a good idea. Keeping passwords in a more secure spot, like written in a notebook that's locked in a drawer or safe, is less risky, but it still puts you at some risk. A secure handwritten list is also better than memorizing and reusing one password for all of your accounts. In fact, the most important thing for password security is that you have complex, distinct passwords for each and every account. Go to cr.org/passwords for tips on how to create strong passwords. That's because if any one account gets hacked, all your accounts with the same passwords become vulnerable. If a company you have an account with gets hacked, change your password and never reuse it. Probably one of the easiest and most secure ways to store passwords is to use a password manager such as iPassword, that's 1Password, which has earned excellent sources for ease of use and security in our tests. Password managers create new and complex passwords for each of your online accounts, storing them in a digital vault protected by a single primary password. To help keep your account safe, set up a multi-factor authentication, a second proof of identity, like a one-time code sent to you via email. My secrets stink. What's the best way to clean them? There are some effective ways to deal with shoe odor. First, try sprinkling a generous amount of baking soda, which absorbs smell and bacteria inside the shoes, and letting them sit overnight, says Kevin Hardy, the owner of Mr. Fresh Laundry Services in New Jersey. Or try using sachets of activated charcoal, which are also effective at absorbing odors. If these messes don't banish the smell from your shoes, it's likely there are bacteria and or fungi in your shoes, both common causes of shoe odor, says CR laundry expert Rich Handel, who leads our testing of washing machines. Your best bet is to hand wash your shoes. Use a detergent and warm water to gently clean both the inside and outside. Make sure you rinse the shoes thoroughly and then allow them to air dry completely, says Zan Senathanby, CEO of Shoe Wash Supreme, a shoe cleaning and repair service in Vancouver, British Columbia. Skip air fresheners, perfume sprays, dryer sheets, and essential oils because many of them will simply mask the smell for a short period of time. If shoe odors are a frequent issue for you, you should also probably rethink your shoe and sock choices, because you're probably wearing poorly ventilated shoes or socks that trap moisture, says Michael Coyer, DPM, a foot and ankle surgeon at Orange County Podiatry in California. And this next one is interesting. A picture of a whole bunch of Halloween candy here. What does 100 calories of Halloween candy look like? At Halloween, many of us welcome trick-or-treaters with a bowl of candy. But we don't dish out treats just to kids. 93% of U.S. adults eat Halloween candies and chocolates as well, says a 2022 National Confectioners Survey. And while the fun size in many versions of classics like Snickers or Reese's look small, they can still pack plenty of calories. So check out just how much of each of these treats you can eat for 100 calories. 2.3 Reese's Miniature Peanut Butter Cups, 13.6 Branch's Candied Corn, 2.4 Kit Kat Miniatures, 4.3 Jolly Ranchers Hard Candy, 8.6 Peanut M&Ms, 10.9 Swedish Fish Minis, 2.4 Hershey's Minis, 24.5 Skittles, oh, that's generous, 1.25 Snickers Fun Size, 10.9 Sour Patch Kids, 13 Haribo Gold Bears, 2 York Chocolate Peppermint Patty Pumpkins. And a couple of light things to close out here. When my son entered his teenage years, he became interested in girls. My husband has handled it wonderfully, explaining everything in an open, honest manner, playing the proper respect for women, and placing the answers within the framework of our religious beliefs. So when I found my son in the game room eyeing a TV screen full of bikini-clad women, I called for my husband. "Honey, your eldest son is up here watching a Sports Illustrated swimsuit special." My husband, up to the challenge, shouted back, "What channel is it on?" Our dog knows way too many phrases now, so my husband and I have resorted to talking like Victoria nobility to get anything by him. "Have you taken the dog on a Brent's adventure recently? Would you escort the canine to the backyard forthwith? Has he supped yet?" You can't scare me. You're not my wife, starting a conversation by saying, "Just so you know." My mother-in-law's friend was ill, so she went to a doctor. "How are you feeling?" the doctor asked. "Lousy. How about you?" she asked. "I feel good, thanks," she replied. "Who's your doctor?" And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thank you again so much for listening.